My name is Deanne Lagerquist. I'm from Northfield, Minnesota, where I teach in the religion department at St. Olaf. And this evening we're starting a three-part series called In Their Own Voice. And tonight's session is entitled African Women's Theology. Because it's the first in the series, I'd like to say a few introductory kind of remarks, actually several introductory kind of remarks. First of all, about the title. Of course, in their own language, that's a reference to Pentecost. And the event that we have recorded for us in Acts, that everyone who was there in the crowd that day in Jerusalem heard Peter speaking in their own language. It's, of course, a reversal of the Old Testament story of Babel, where the languages were confused and no one could understand each other. Now, in Pentecost, we have this miracle of people hearing in their own language. What we don't have is any indication of communication across the languages, and that's, I think, a problem with that wonderful image of in their own language. We don't know how, if there's communication across, and that's part of what I want to talk about tonight, not just... We'll wait just a minute here as people are coming in. I started too soon. So I'm concerned not just about the fact that people hear in their own language, but how we hear each other in several languages. Behind the things that I'll talk about in these three sessions are several presuppositions, and let me be upfront about those. First of all, that I think that there is this great miracle of Pentecost and continuing through the centuries that does allow the gospel to be heard in many languages and in many cultures. It's the claim of Christianity that the truth that we have in the gospel is universal, applicable to all people in all times and all places. That's a very, very big claim. We don't always let it happen, but we do make that claim. We're also, I think it's important to acknowledge, we're witnesses to an era in which we're awakening to the ways that we have made that not happen, the way there have been barriers to Christianity put up, particularly by Western culture, and that we've obscured the gospel by confusing, one might say, the language with the message. At the same time, we are also in an age when people are not only hearing in their own language, but they're beginning to speak the gospel back in their own language. So that there are several dynamics that are going on. One, we're claiming that the gospel is universal. Two, we know that Western culture in both European and American forms has frequently, in the last two centuries, obscured the gospel. But also, we see in recent years that the gospel has nonetheless been more powerful than our obstructions, and it has been heard by people of other languages and other cultures, and that they're speaking that back. And it may be helpful for us of North American parentage to think about that a little bit in terms of immigration. And I know that my grandparents, and especially my great-grandparents, went through this problem of language and culture. That what they had learned in Norwegian or Swedish or Danish, in my particular case, had to be translated into English. And that was a difficult and painful thing, but a process that I'm very grateful for. That if that hadn't happened, my life would be very different and the church would be very different. So I think that we have some things in our own heritage that may be helpful. The miracle that allows people around the world to hear the gospel in their own language allows us to hear them speak back to us. And there are a variety of components, I think, to that miracle. One of them we must acknowledge is that the Holy Spirit is active. And one of the ways I think the Holy Spirit is active is that we have imagination. When we talk about issues of particularity and inclusiveness, it's very easy to become paralyzed and say, my experience is not your experience. I want to respect your experience, and thereby close our ears and think we can't hear. And I'm convinced that it is indeed the spirit working through our imagination that allows us to hear something, allows us to speak to each other, just as those same things allow us to speak across generations, or in the kind of work that I usually do, across centuries. And I've tried occasionally to make the argument that historians are always doing cross-cultural work, because if I'm talking about the Middle Ages, that's real far from 20th century Northfield, Minnesota. I mean, it's a totally different culture. At the same time, I have to acknowledge that even though the title of this series is in their own language, I'm reading in translation almost entirely. Some of the stuff that I'm reading was written in English, but most of it is translated out of another language. Some of it has been translated twice to get it into English. And that's particularly the case with some of the African materials, that they're written in some native African language and then perhaps translated into French and then from French into English. So there is this translation process. There's also a kind of translation because it's not my life that's being written about. Also, let me acknowledge, I am a beginner. Some of you may know much more about this than I do because of your reading or because of your experience. And if that's so, I encourage you to share that and to contribute to this as we go along. If what you have are questions and observations that are coming immediately, don't hesitate to break in. Let me say what my tools are. First of all, books. Okay, those are the tools of my trade. How am I learning this? If I'm reading books. And very consciously, I think these people have written in English in part so that people like us can learn, also so they can speak to each other. My second tool is that I know something about American women's theology and the history of European American Christianity. It's not the same thing, but it's similar, and I bring those tools. And then thirdly, my historian skills, which are listening, empathy, and imagination. I have two goals for this series. One, that we try to hear what these women of the third world hear when they hear in their own language. So the first goal is to listen with them and try to hear what the gospel is when they hear it. The gospel is, of course, one thing, but the gospel comes to each of us where we are and answers our own needs for healing. So we want to listen with them. The second goal is to consider what the gospel sounds like to us when we hear it in their language. So to listen to them. Okay? To listen with them and to listen to them. To pay attention, we might say, to their accent. And one of the ways we're going to do this is that I have a lot of little quotations to read to you. I hope this works. If it's not working, give me at least body language or tell me that it's not working, you know. A brief quotation then from Consuelo del Prado, where she talks about her theology with this metaphor of an accent. When we speak of the feminine perspective, we are referring to an accent, not proposing a polarization. Nevertheless, that accent must be strong enough to emphasize the just claim of the silent or neglected aspects of ordinary speech. In this respect, the comment made by Matilda, the wife of Firmin, who was one of the protagonists in José María Argudáez's novel, All Blood, seems appropriate. I sense God in another way. This phrase demands the right to sense and then also to express our distinct experience of God differently. You know how it is when you hear someone read the lessons in church who has a little bit of an accent? It gives it a new twist. You can hear it differently somehow. And I hope in part that that's what listening to third world women theology will help us to do, to hear the gospel and to help us hear it anew. It's also kind of like traveling. You know how when you travel, you see things differently in contrast. Okay, I have two other kinds of introductory comments. First, some general impressions from my readings of third world theology. And the first one comes originally out of conversations I had with a student last spring. Her name is Sydney Van Dyke, and she'd spent 6 months in Java. And she was working with me on her senior project, in which one piece was trying to work on feminist theology from a Javanese setting. And as Sydney and I talked about this over and over and over, and her struggles as an American feminist being in that setting, and the things she found difficult and the things she found appealing, one of the things that became very clear to both of us is that there's a real advantage to being non-Western when you're trying to figure out which part is Christianity and which part is the package. And we decided it's because there's this, those people have the advantage of two cultures, their own perhaps primary culture and a secondary culture. We can't always see which piece is Christianity and which piece is Western culture, because they've grown up so tightly together, like some of these trees that I see when I walk along out here. You know, you can't tell if it's two trees or three trees or one tree. It's hard for us to see that. I will get to bibliography here in a minute. This wonderful book, With Passion and Compassion, in the introduction, speaks about third world as a kind of perspective and claims the title Third World for their own. This is what we call ourselves. The current move to introduce the term two-thirds world, which you may have heard recently, attempts to acknowledge that in geographical space, and certainly in population, those who occupy the underside of the purchasing and ruling powers in the human community constitute more than a third. As a part of the Ecumenical Association of Third World Theologians, we maintain our stance and our name for the third world in this sense seeks to present a different reality, a reality not dependent on numbers or location. Originally, a choice to stay unaligned either with the capitalist West or the socialist East, the term third world has accrued to itself deep theological meaning as persons from those geographical areas marked by poverty and oppression began to theologize and to discover the underside of the industrialized affluent North. So they're saying where we stand gives us a different way to see, and we want to call that third world. A second important kind of generalization I want to make about what I've been reading in third world theology, feminist, is that at least the things that I have read focus very much on constructing a new church or envisioning a new church out of the Bible. That's in contrast to a great deal of European Euro-American feminist theology that tends to have its focus not always on the whole of the church. And most of the third world women's theology that I've read describes itself in something like this. This is by a woman from Hong Kong. Women are called to restore inclusiveness, equality, and harmony in the church. They are called to do away with control and the grabbing of power in all human relationships. They are also called not to abandon the church or to surrender to apathy. They are called to be confident in spirit, deepening their experience of the Christ within the church so that the church can be renewed. A similarity to European American feminist theology is an effort to redefine what theology is and to take that out of a more abstract exercise to make it an exercise in praxis or practicality. A couple of historical comments. were coming in a circle. In the 19th century missionary movement, there was a phrase, women's work for women. And female missionaries were sent out especially to work with women in other countries who were sometimes called something like our heathen sisters. It's a difficult phase of Christian history to evaluate. It's real difficult because a bunch of things were going on all at once. It's hard to sort it all out, and it's hard to sort out all the consequences. One of the consequences of that is that there are an incredible number of female physicians in India. Okay, because of the particular way that American notions of appropriate female behavior and traditional Indian views of women and men's interactions came together. They founded medical schools for women, much more than we have here. Another thing that happened is that Christianity tended to be presented as being better for women than whatever the indigenous religion was. Okay, and it was easy to make that case. You say, well, back home in Omaha, we don't throw widows on the funeral pyre. Back home in Minneapolis, we don't bind little girls' feet. So that there was this dichotomy that was set up. Christianity is good for women. Buddhism, Confucianism, Hinduism is bad for women. And consequently, the missionaries did some things that probably were good for the women there. I think one of the things they did here was convince women that Christianity was maybe better for them than it was. Okay. Some bibliography before we move then to Africa. I've written these on the board. Some of them are available in the bookstore. This book, With Passion and Compassion, is divided up, just as we will be doing in this series, Africa, Asia, and Latin America. It's essays, and it's very, very good. It's a fine book. This one, New Eyes for Reading, Biblical and Theological Reflections by Women from the Third World, Shorter, More Meditations. Inheriting Our Mother's Garden, Feminist Theology and Third World Perspective, unlike the other two, includes work by American minority women. Okay, and that's an issue that people have to face when they work with third world theology. Will you include minority persons from North America and Europe? This project that came from the Ecumenical Association of Third World Theologians made a conscious decision not to include those people. Okay, and so I'm not going to talk about them. The Church and Women in the Third World, this is described as empirical studies. Really what it means is they're mostly historical studies. They're not theological kinds of essays. And then I have another up there. I don't have a copy of Speaking of Faith, Global Perspectives on Women, Religion, and Social Change. That's a much more broad kind of book. Okay, now, Africa. I want to begin by a statement of faith by an African woman, okay, so that you can hear what she says about what she believes, which I think is a way of hearing how the gospel sounds to her. Teresa Sugona of Cameroon. Jesus Christ means everything to me. As an African woman, a Christian, one consecrated to the service of God in God's church and in the world, I believe in Jesus Christ. For me, Christ is the true human, the one who makes it possible for all persons to reach fulfillment and to overcome the historic alienations weighing them down. For me, that faith entails unconditional adherence to the God revealed in Jesus Christ, the one whom God has highly exalted above every name, so that at Jesus' name every knee should bow in heaven, on earth, and under the earth, and every tongue should proclaim that Jesus Christ is Lord in the glory of God the Father. For me, this unconditional belonging to God of Jesus Christ means entering into the Paschal mystery, It is a desire growing deeper within me each day to know Christ, to commune with his sufferings. And this is real important in Third World Women's Theology, this notion of suffering. Or particularly I'll emphasize tonight talking about African sacrifice, which goes nicely with the stuff Walt has been doing this week. To open myself to the power of his resurrection. And this also is important, that there seems to be in this third world material a real close linking of suffering and hope. Just really close. They always seem to be in the same sentence. To be open to the action of the Holy Spirit who builds the church and the history of human beings. It is a matter of deep attitudes and of motivations and of operative meanings. The realism of the cross every day tells me as a woman of the third world that the laws of history can be overcome by means of crucified love. Again, there's something very characteristic there. The laws of history can be overcome by means of crucified love. There's also, and I'll say this again when we come to look at the Latin Americans on Saturday, a sense of the concrete, that religious truths have power to change social realities. The African context, of course, is important for African women's theology. That's one of the primary principles of feminist theology generally. I don't think it's a principle that was totally absent from theology before, but it certainly hadn't been emphasized, the importance of context, of contextuality. North Africa was early on a stronghold of Christianity in the first centuries. But with the coming of Islam, we lost North Africa. And the history of Christianity was really changed by that loss. The Christianity then had to be reintroduced into Africa by missionaries, Euro-American, coming from Euro-American churches. Of course, the Portuguese and the Spanish began that as they began to explore, but it really took off in the mid-19th century. One of the things that contributed to that was David Livingstone's publications of his travels in Africa. I describe this to my students by reminding them after Crocodile Dundee how suddenly everyone was really into Australia. And I think it's a similar dynamic. He brought Africa to the public imagination, and suddenly a lot of people went there. It's linked with colonization. People who went to Africa as missionaries went to places where their countries had colonies. And they went with their own languages. So Christianity didn't come as some essence, which of course it can't, because we only know Christianity as it is in us. And it's in our lives, and it affects the way we live. So, of course, the missionaries took that with them. Last week I talked a little bit about Amanda Berry Smith, an American black woman who was a missionary in Africa. Not everyone who went to do that work was a white European or a white American, but for the most part they were. In contemporary Africa, there are other options, of course, to Christianity. And that's one of the things that makes third world theology different from European or American theology, is that in most of those places, Christianity is a minority religion, and a relatively recent minority religion. It's not taken for granted. The other options in Africa include the traditional religions of Africa, the tribal religions, and one of the authors I have been reading notes, no one escapes from their traditional religion. I wonder if it's like none of us escapes from our popular culture. Those things are always there. And it seems as I read this material that in African traditional religions, one of the places that really sticks is in life cycle rituals and marking of life cycle things, transitions. Another option is Islam, and as you probably know, Islam is growing and very vital in Africa today. A third option is more difficult to describe. I've used the term independent Christianity. And there can describe that in different ways. Someone else has called it new religions. Sometimes these are churches that have broken off from missionary-based churches. Sometimes they're an effort to take Christianity and the traditional religion and somehow put them together.
Mm-hmm. Are they sometimes called primitive churches too? Like in Ghana? Are you thinking of Ghana?
Ghana is a place where they have them, yeah.
Yeah.
And primal. But if they use the term primal, it usually means the indigenous religion. These are usually religions that have some Christian component, mm-hmm. but it may be nearly unrecognizable to us. Yeah. And if you're interested in that, there is a good essay about the role of women in new religions in this book. Christianity was and has been, for African women, a mixed blessing. And this essay by a Nigerian and a Kenyan puts it this way. Christianity has come as a mixed blessing for the African woman. It promised an elevated personal dignity and an equality with the menfolk, yet never quite brought about the fullest enjoyment of that promise. Nevertheless, being naturally or incurably religious, the African woman has accepted Christianity as her new religion. She has thrown herself into it with a zeal that surpasses that of men. Deep down, she remains African, but permits the new faith to enrich her traditional person without experiencing any spiritual conflict. Religion, belief in God, is the integrating factor in her life. Her life is religious. As a Christian, she witnesses to the depth of her commitment to her family and to the Christian community. In times of crisis, she would most likely resort to her traditional rituals. She most certainly would not leave anything undone if it was likely to affect her children adversely. Western theologians have labeled this syncretism. We believe that the best judge of what this phenomenon in religion really connotes is the African woman, and she is yet to be consulted by the theologians. This issue of syncretism is a difficult one. How do you put together what was and what comes? We have done it lots, but we don't recognize it very much. Except around Christmas time, there's always someone who writes a letter or an article about how Christmas trees are really pagan Germanic symbols, you know, or the Easter egg is some symbol of fertility from some pre-Christian thing, you know. We have those little things that we use, which are very strange to many non-European American Christians. I teach with a woman who's from South Africa, and she said the first year she was in America, she could not be these eggs and rabbits at Easter time. She said, what does this have to do with anything?
It's called commercialism.
Yeah. But the Ukrainian Easter eggs, you know, there was something Hallmark didn't invent it. Somebody invented it before Hallmark decided to sell it. Okay. And so I just say that to remind us to be a little humble about this issue of syncretism and what we've put on and what maybe could be shed and something else added. Certainly we don't want to make Christianity into something else and still call it Christianity, but we want to be careful about deciding which things are and aren't. Paul had a few problems with that too, as you'll recall, about what do you do with sacrificed meat? And what do you do with circumcision? And what do you do with this and this and this? It's always a difficult issue. Some of the themes that come back again and again as I read African women. One, it's interest in domestic rituals. That has to do with life cycle. It has to do with things in the home. in traditional African religions, and of course here I'm generalizing just incredibly, because Africa is a huge continent with lots of different traditions. But we're just having a beginning, so I'm going to generalize. In many African traditional religions, women have an important role to play in the domestic part of religion, just as Jewish women do in the domestic part of their religious practice. And so there's this call for Christianity to provide something like that. Rituals that address day-to-day life and life cycle changes, and to mark those parts of life. The centrality of life. Religion as life-centered rather than death-centered. Religion is about living. Again and again, that theme reoccurs, not just in the African material, but very much in the African material. As probably shouldn't be a surprise after I've mentioned an interest in domestic ritual, there's a concern for the structure. Again, this is an interesting contrast to what goes on in American feminist discourse. We're getting to the point where we can talk about that more, but there was a period when that wasn't a very popular topic. African women seem much more willing to use words like complementarity, which, you know, I kind of go, what do you mean? Complementarity, what's that about? What do you mean? That's very dangerous, very, very dangerous. They don't seem quite as afraid of that. They don't seem quite as afraid of what I might call a kind of essentialism, to say women have concerns about life because they can be mothers. And they are pretty, it seems to, I read this pretty carefully, it does seem like they're saying because they can be, not because they are. But they aren't as, they don't make quite as big a deal out of it as I would make out of it. Let me just give you an example of how motherhood comes into some of their writing. 56. I should have noted. This, again, a Nigerian. And she's lifting out some themes for reading biblical rereading. Rereading the Bible demands that emphasis be placed on the vocation of woman as mother, God's privileged instrument for conceiving and bringing forth life. In the past, insufficient recognition has been given to this singular role of women in society. This emphasis will go hand in hand with sustained efforts to develop and celebrate the motherhood of God. For though in the last analysis, God is neither man nor woman, the human categories we use to express our knowledge of God help us in our relationship with God. Our celebration of the motherhood of God will help us to approach God and Jesus as compassionate, merciful, and tender givers of life and refuge of sinners, rather than as mighty lords to be feared and appeased. In general, children, African children in particular, fear and obey their fathers who have power and authority, but they love and feel most secure with their mothers who enable growth in them. Let us allow God to be our mother as well as our father. The gain will be wholly ours. Okay. I don't know very many American feminist theologians who would write that paragraph that simply, without qualifications. And there doesn't seem to be the same hesitancy about that. There is a desire that the church will play a prophetic role in society, that the church should be a force for full human development. African nations are in a stage of development, figuring out how they're going to be in the 21st century. And African Christian women are calling for the church to be a part of that, not to let it just go on. They are not ready to have easy contextualization. Interesting. Big word in third world theology and any kind of theology these days. Contextualization. Make the message fit with what's there. Pay attention to the context. African women say, we got to be careful about that because not everything that has made women's lives difficult comes from the West. Some of it is native. Some of it is indigenous. And the South African woman that I was reading says it's the very same dynamic in sexism and in racism. And we can't just address the problem of racism and let sexism be. And she's very emphatic about that. African women are astute. That just to say, let's make an African theology may not address their needs, address their concerns, allow them to bring their gifts. They also address, of course, the legacy of colonialism and paternalism, which includes Western Christianity, the patriarchy of both Islam and traditional religions. Okay. That's all general. Let me just stop for a minute and see if you have responses or questions before I go on to speak more specifically about the work of one theologian.
What does it mean that, how do they do their work?
Method?
No, what qualifies them as theologians? I mean, are they teachers? Or
well,
are they...
and this next part I'm going to talk about may help that. Most of the women who are represented in this book have formal theological training, okay, in seminaries and universities.
In Africa?
Some, but my eye falls here, for example, on Rosemary Edit from Nigeria, is a Roman Catholic sister, holds a PhD in religion and culture from Catholic University, Washington, D.C. Okay, that's a pretty good credential. The woman I'm going to talk about, Mercy Amba Ojuyoye, was educated at the University of Ghana and Cambridge University, and she's the Deputy General Secretary of the World Council of Churches. Okay, but along with that, and this is across the board, there's a real concern for what they describe as grassroots theology, women who may be illiterate, but who speak about God, who are concerned about how Christianity is lived out. Maybe I should go back to something I skipped over about the way theology is being defined. Page 10. For the purposes of this discussion, we are describing theology in terms of the ways in which knowledge of God and God's will for humanity and the universe are understood and responded to. And then this woman talks about grassroots theologizing, theologizing that takes place in Christian communities, particularly in Bible study, and then a sort of third kind, which is women who have formal training. And that third kind should take account of the other two.
Has there been an Africa the kind of base community movement?
In Africa, not as much as Latin America. Okay. This book, and maybe it's helpful to hear how it came about. There's this group called the Ecumenical Association of Third World Theologians, which met in New Delhi in 81. As so often happens, there was a sort of consciousness raising that happened, and women began to say they wanted to talk about theology with women. And they made a three-tier process, first national meetings, continental meetings, and then an international meeting in Mexico City in, I think it's 86? Yeah, December of 86. And so this is essays that were prepared in that process and then the final statements from the continental meetings and the Mexico City Conference. And they had topics. They talked about Bible, Christology, spirituality, church, and another topic that escapes me right now. Okay. All right. Let's look then at the work of one theologian. She describes herself metaphorically as the mother of twins, the twins of what is and what is yet to be. And it's this struggle within her. In one of her essays, she tells us that there are five generations of Methodist church women in Ghana. And that was really helpful for me to see the ways that, at least in Ghana and in the Methodist church, women have moved and changed in their participation in the church. She places herself in the third generation. The first generation, Nana, are women who were in their childbearing years in 19-teens. Very likely they were converts to Christianity. They tended to be traders. And consequently, they often heard the gospel first in the marketplace. They participated in worship by raising lyrics, which sounds, and of course I haven't ever heard it, but the way she describes it sounds to me like lining out songs, but they made them up on the basis of what they heard, and so it could be an interruption in the sermon that they would just start to do this. And it's a kind of adaptation of what would have gone on in a traditional worship. They might even have been class leader of a Methodist class of women, which is a small group kind of thing that John Wesley developed. And they gave, this is very interesting to me, she says they gave their children Christian names, but they had the traditional rites of passage. So you see there this mixing together of old and new. The second generation, the women born during World War I, had some formal education. They might have been teachers or nurses. They might have been married to pastors. They were often leaders of classes, but they didn't have a part in the liturgy because this lyric intervention dropped out. They didn't do that anymore. And they saw Westernization as liberation from African sexism. They took the missionary wife as their model, and they wanted to be like the missionary's wives. And that's kind of the setting in which Mercy, I will call her by her first name because I stumble so in such an ugly way over her last name. I perhaps do her more honor by saying her first name correctly than her last name badly. That's what her mother was that. So she grew up in a Methodist manse. She was a pastor's kid. She said of her generation, they were born in the 30s and the 40s. Frequently, they had college education. And she says, none could afford to ignore them, yet at the same time, and this is her phrase, they had little time to give to the church to misuse. So a sort of awareness that maybe they had gifts that weren't really being used and unwillingness to let that happen. The fourth generation, women who are now in their 20s and 30s, she describes as theologians, the women who have formalized training, for whom ordination has become an issue. And the fifth generation is, of course, the women who are adolescents now. In this book, New Eyes for Reading, she has a wonderful essay, Church Women and the Church's Mission. And she begins by saying women do not play a role in the church because they are not outsiders who come in to play a role. That's her first supposition. Women are in the church. Women belong to the church. They don't play a role. They are the church. Okay. I think that makes a big difference in this sort of constructive tone that I described in the themes. If you begin by assuming it's mine, that's different than beginning by saying, let me in. Okay. Then she goes on to say that she's concerned about how the church is doing its mission. And she says you can't separate the method from the mission itself. and suggests that women can be a model for the church and how it should do its mission. Particularly, she takes there Mary, the mother of Jesus, and the Magnificat, and that notion of being a servant, which brings her then to her central theme, which is sacrifice. Sacrifice is crucial. The church must be sacrificial. Oh, very scary. Very scary. Do we really want to say this? What does she mean by sacrifice? Here's her definition. It's the recognition of one's sinfulness and willingness to seek and accept the forgiveness of God, which we receive upon leaving our own way to follow God's. Okay, recognition of sinfulness, willingness to seek forgiveness, because we are leaving our own way to follow God's. But, quickly, she says, making a sacrifice does not equal being sacrificed. There's a difference. She's not talking about being a victim. She's not talking about Japheth's daughter. Okay? When Japheth says, whoever I see first will be a sacrifice. She's not talking about that. She's not talking about Isaac. She's talking about Jesus. And she describes this in particularly in relation to a group of women she calls the pillars of the church. If I can find it. I'm sorry, I've written down the wrong page. Oh, here it is. Growing up in the Methodist monasteries of Ghana, I became familiar with the phrase, the pillars of the church. And if any of you have ever been to the Science Museum in Chicago, you've seen these statues of women who are holding up the building. That's what image comes to my mind. Referring to women who give themselves up to the work of the church. Strong posts that almost literally hold up the roofs of chapels with money and physical strength, as well as with power and silence of a column in a cathedral. When they speak, the whole fabric of the church quakes with what I see as an unnecessary fear. The fear that the status quo will be upset. Fear that the magnificent edifices of suppression will collapse. And a faithless fear that when it does, a more appropriate structure cannot emerge. Allowing such fears to paralyze the church is for me a declaration that human sin is bound to prevail against the will of God. A statement no Christian will subscribe to, but to which many bow by the lives they live. So she contrasts being sacrificed with making a sacrifice and suggests that being sacrificed, as happens to many women, perhaps even those pillars of the church who we think are holding up the roof, results in what she describes as permanent expected kenosis, referring to the Philippians passage about Jesus emptying himself, which she says is voluntary, not permanent, and not expected. And what happens when people are made into sacrifices is that they are permanently expected always to be emptying themselves. And that's not Jesus' model, she says. Okay. Nonetheless, she goes back, women have demonstrated, even when they are being made sacrifices, rather than sacrificing themselves, the necessity for sacrifice in order to be in mission. And here's her message then for the church in Africa. It cannot continue to grasp at power, but must sacrifice security and risk calamity, if not persecution, if it's going to be in mission. So this is one of the things very interesting and very distinctive about this theology, is saying, look, we've done it wrong. We've allowed people to be sacrificed, but let's not let that make us afraid of sacrifice. She sees that women are being sacrificed, particularly to two things, and this brings her to the issue of ordination. She says women are sacrificed so that things will remain the same and for unity. And particularly there, it's the issue of women's ordination. And she points, in one of her most, shall I say, least gentle passages at those churches who have ordained women but seem to waver as they lust for Rome. If those churches really believe in women's ministry, they will challenge Rome rather than acquiescing to Rome. If women are being sacrificed and if the church is itself sacrificed by its members on the altar of conformity, she says, there is no martyrdom because there is no witness and no confession. So if you make someone else sacrifice, you don't get martyrdom, you don't get confession, you don't get witness. And so she's really calling her church into account, doing it with a very conventional, traditional model. Let me just end then with, is this the right one? No, it's here. A little poem that she has here. Dream, girl, dream. What's the future going to be? Dream, girl, dream. What we may become, that's what matters. Dream, woman, dream. Woman, dream, Africa's dream. Dream of the least of the world, permissible dreams. Dream, for the other is you turned inside out. Make the other strong and you will be strong. We shall all be strong together. Dream, girl, dream. Be a woman and Africa will be strong. Okay. I think I did manage to finish with a few minutes left. So I ask you what your response is.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking while you're going through all this, I had some African women over who were attending the University of Oregon other than Eugene.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about some of their customs now, this, I don't know if this is even related to what you discussed, but we got into quite a heavy discussion about their customs of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And they still have the, and these were Lutherans, by the way. They were very strong Lutherans.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking that they still have the old custom of the man sort of having to buy the woman by a dowry, how many things he could come to the father with.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was very interesting. I didn't realize that they had that custom yet. Now, I don't know what that relates to what you've been discussing all evening, but I thought of this as maybe that's, you know, one of their, they're still retaining some of those old customs. Maybe that's one of the baggage that they're still carrying. I don't know.
And figuring out how that works. Yeah, and in Africa, of course, one of the issues has been for a long time how to deal with polygamy. And at first, missionaries thought they knew what to do about polygamy. And they generally made a real mess of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But these were very intelligent gals. They were both working toward their doctorates, and but it was still that they still relied on that. That was really, and they laughed about how some of these customs took over their lives because you know they wanted to get married to this man, but gee, he didn't come with enough. Enough of his worldly goods to produce to the father. So on. I thought that was very interesting.
Yes, sir.
Do they have any conflicts of some the various phrases of the Bible? Essentially say women are subservient. Do they have a problem with that, dealing with it?
Well, yeah, and there was another set of meetings that the World Council did with the project and the community of women and men in the church that addressed that and looked particularly at critical verses. And I read some of that. There's an article by Connie Parvey that she reports particularly on the African meeting and the Asian meeting. And there I was struck very much how it's real similar to the way American and European feminists deal with those passages. They're looked at historically. The interpretation over the years is tried to be stripped away So they deal with it very much as American and European feminists do.
Yeah.